They are not prisoners of a moralism, a legalism. They are free, free with the freedom of the children of God. In their home one breathes the open air of God. They make you long for God. Is joy sinful? Each century has moralists, writers who counsel, condemn, distinguish. One of their favorite themes since the war is anxiety, an anxiety which is closely related to anguish. If you believe them, then anxiety is the great virtue. To sleep well is thoughtlessness, to be happy is an insult to the suffering of men. But having a bad conscience, that is the state of grace. Willingly they cite the words of a certain heroine. There will always be a stray dog somewhere who will keep me from being happy. If the Redder rebels, arguing that in such an atmosphere he feels like he is about to be asphyxiated, our moralists reprove him anew. How can you laugh, while others cry? How dare you read your paper tranquilly by the fireside when so many others have neither hearth nor home? How can you dance on the rumbling volcano? Christians themselves end up having a bad conscience and wonder if joy is perhaps not sinful. However, an instinct in them protests, it is not the vulgar joys of life that claims these rights, it is something deeper. And the words of Christ rise up, "Ask and you shall receive, in order that your joy may be perfect." No one will be able to steal your joy. These words of Saint Paul, too, "Rejoice without ceasing in the Lord," I repeat, rejoice. Joy. Anxiety. It is perplexing. Where is the truth? Our joys are tributaries of our loves. Observe that when his wife and children are happy, joy lives in the heart of the husband. When they are in trouble, joy slips away from him. For the Christian, the first love, not only first in dignity, but first in strength and in reality, is the love of his God. It is the love of Christ. And if Christ is in joy, and he is, for his death has vanquished suffering and death, then there flows from the deepest wells of the Christian soul this subterranean river of indestructible joy, precisely what Christ promised to his disciples. But this love of Christ that causes the joy of the Christian also is the source of his sorrow. To love Christ is to love those whom he loves, especially those whom he cherishes above all, the crippled, the rejected, the lowly. The heart of the Christian opens itself to the rising tide of human suffering, that of the millions of displaced persons who have left country and home, sometimes losing their children en route, or that of their Christian brothers behind the Iron Curtain, that of socially suppressed and politically emerging peoples in colonial areas, and also the distress of many closer to home. The day he opens himself to the love of Christ and, through him, to the suffering of men, what will become of his tranquility? Compassion becomes a devouring passion in his heart. Whether he is in the subway, in the street or at the shop, he wills the constancy of prayer and of offering. The trouble of the men who live there he offers to God. This joy of Christ that sings from the depths of himself is without ceasing until God reconciles him to all his brothers. Champion of the unfortunate, close to the Lord, he intends also to help them. Since it is not really possible to wish them joy and not to divide his bread with them, he gives to the poor. To help the poor is good. But it is not the whole duty of the Christian. To pretend to suffer from the distress of the world and not to try to reform the world is inconsistent. A civilization collapses perhaps justly for having founded the tranquility of some on the misery of others. New structures emerge from the ruins. The Christian of today must cooperate in the construction of a better world. Thus the heart of the Christian, I speak of the true disciple of Christ, is heavy with the immense human suffering and also with the enormous sin of the world. An anxiety consumes him, it is true, but it is the anxiety of Saint Paul, who is weak, that I do not myself feel weak, who has fallen without a fire devouring me. Nevertheless, the sorrow of men does not replace the joy of God in him. Moreover, this joy by contrast is the measure of his sorrow, it is joy, and not sterile anguish, which always urges upon us the aid of those in want. seeing good. I had intended to write on benevolence, willing the good of another, to analyze this disposition so necessary to life in common. On second thought, I have decided to speak to you of another disposition, still more fundamental, the introducer and imitator of benevolence. There is no name for it in English. Not having one, we will call it seeing good, the ability to see the good of others who surround us. It is the gift of a happy nature, the symptom of a well-functioning faith, some will say. Not at all, it is an art. And a difficult art. I remember a page of de Hamel. It was wartime. For 2 years he lived side by side with a silent companion who seemed empty of soul. Then one day this taciturn person let escape a word whose intonation alerted de Hamel. Had he, then, unsuspected depths in him? De Hamel decided to find out. For days and days I stayed there, with pickaxe and the little miner's lamp. Since the time I think with astonishment of those little explored subterranean passages where there are rivers, colonnades, domes. In the presence of every person, it is necessary at first to convince oneself that one does not really know him, and then to make an act of faith in his profound depth, intelligence, wealth of heart, and what is still more precious, the image of God in him. The discovery is astonishing. This explanation of the interior world of a human being demands patient labor, a passionate, respectful, ardent and tireless attention to his tastes, aptitudes, aspirations, enthusiasms, a thousand signs which allow us to perceive a secret life. But do not forget the recommendations of the fox to the little prince: one sees well only with the heart. That which is important is invisible to the eye. Eutropia. Eutropia is not a new baptismal name. It is not a saint, but a virtue. This strange word in fact slips timidly into the catalogue of virtues set up by solemn moralists. From the little attention they give to it, it evidently seems that Eutropia is in the eyes of these wise men only a giggling girl in an assembly of queens. But you are no austere moralist, that is why I invite you to welcome little Eutropia. If you so desire, you will find some information about her in the Summa Theologica, A.I.L.A.E., Q. 168a. 2. Eutropia is simply good humor. The practice of this small virtue is of great importance in social life, especially in the life of the family. There are many varieties of good humor: the good humor of youth, a superabundance of vitality; the good humor of a fine day, daughter of the sun rather than of virtue; the innate good humor of happy temperaments, exuberant good humor, often more tiresome than helpful; and also a certain ascetic good humor which resembles a grimace more than a smile. What we eulogize here is not a function of health, weather, or circumstance. It has its source in the heart of the soul. Moreover, it possesses varied nuances. Sometimes discreet, appearing as a light, sometimes laughing, sweeping us away in a dance, conquering, it wins us away from anger, penetrating, it warms frozen hearts. But it is impossible to define. It is as mobile as the faces it brightens. Don't think that good humor is the virtue of the indifferent, or of those who run away from the serious things in life, from human drama, from the suffering of body and of soul. Reflect, rather, if you judge it to be superficial, on the virtues of which it is the sign and the fruit. It requires first of all the qualities of spirit, the knowledge of true values, which refuses to make dramas out of the subjects of an operetta. It requires the optimistic regard of experience which realizes the truth of the proverb, "Every cloud has a silver lining." It requires also that sense of humor whose discreet note we can discern in many of the words of Christ. Still more than these qualities of spirit, good humor supposes a number of virtues: faith and love of God, which establishes peace in hearts, like the staff in the hand of the traveler. Good humor is a victory of forgetfulness of self. But it is the Christian love of one's neighbor which more than any other virtue engenders good humor, Good humor is to it what the smile is to the face. Good humor is politeness of heart. Eutropia is not an insignificant virtue. It is not only those which precede it that justify its importance, it is also those which it sustains. To acquire the mastery of self, few ways are as efficacious. Without it all is laborious, with it all becomes easy. Fruit of love and of true happiness, it is the creator of love and happiness in the family, thanks to its power of union and of reconciliation. And certainly, if it is not a question every day of reconciliation, in the strict sense of the word, there are very often little displeasures to dissipate. It achieves this miracle. First, it reconciles creatures with themselves, the first condition of the reconciliation with others. It reconciles them with life as well, with humble tasks and great duties. Those who practice it may well merit the beatitude addressed to the workers of peace: happy are the peacemakers, they will be called children of God. If Eutropia reigns at your house, she will communicate her tonality to things and persons. The other virtues will share in her grace. The work of education will be facilitated and more efficacious. All their life children raised in her climate are endowed with serenity and happiness. I hope that you understand why, in the grave times in which we live, I do not hesitate to speak to you of a virtue which can appear light to those who have not weighed it. If you practice the duty of sitting down of which I spoke previously, don't neglect to ask yourself about the duty of good humor. Because it is a question of duty. It is also a question of acquiring the habit. All men possess the germs of it but do not develop it without a patient effort. Its practice without failure demands now and then a true heroism. As paradoxical as it may seem, good humor is an ascetic virtue, but an ascetic virtue of which those nearby will not complain. This is not true of every exercise of penance. If I may judge by this remark of a husband, my wife wears a hair shirt but it is me that it scratches. What are vacations for? First of all, what do we call vacations? I would define them loosely: the time of interruption of habitual work, scholarly, professional, household. While it appears that schoolboys and men generally have vacations, the mothers of the families have just as much need of it, a remark made in passing for the attention of the husbands. Upon return from the holidays, I often observe among parents what the teachers observe among their students: a collapse of spiritual vitality. Their energies are exhausted. Should increase of physical activity necessarily mark the decline of spiritual vitality? This would be very unfortunate, but it seems to be so. Where does this decline come from? From the abandoning during vacation of habitual religious exercises? Perhaps, but not necessarily. It seems to me that that is not the primary reason. It is rather in the interior order. On vacations one takes a vacation from a love of God and neighbor, taking as a motto, "I will do as I please." Play, sleep, walk, read, all are commanded by this sovereign law. Understand, it is not the resting, the change of base, the sports that I find reprehensible, although sometimes these may be abused, but rather the motive, whatever I feel like doing. From this comes the perpetual attention to self, and therefore inattention to God and to others. From this comes the preference of self to the detriment of others. All during the year the question hardly comes up of doing what you please. You try to do the will of God, if not always seen as the will of God, at least under the aspect of duty. Then what happens on vacation? You reverse the values. As if, in order to rest yourself from having loved and served God and others during 11 months, you now love yourself. A holiday is for the indulgence of self. There is the error. There are no vacations from love. You do not cease to breathe during vacations. Therefore you do not cease to love. Love is the respiration of the soul. You are right to interrupt your routine tasks. But do it because it is the will of God and in the measure that it is.